Our speaker tonight is the Reverend Adonna Lay, who is a minister of All Faith Fellowship in Tyler, Texas. He is a native of British Guiana, and he came to the United States when he was 15 years old. He has done research on prayer techniques of the North American and Canadian Indians, and he was in Mexico for a year with the Mayan and Aztec Indians. He has Indian, Spanish, and Chinese heritage from his mother, and also his Catholic religion in which he was reared. However, he took his faith from his father, a Mongolian, and came into the Eastern teachings. He can reconcile both East and West because of his particular heritage. He is speaking to us this evening on the teachings of Jesus and Bible interpretation. Swami Nityananda Saraswata.
Before I speak to you, normally you are accustomed to calling this a lecture, but to a Swami, this is a satsanga, far more than a lecture. And at a satsanga, you have to calibrate the minds of the individual listening with the mind of the speaker. And to do that, now we are in attunement extrasensory, mentally and physically. The teachings of Jesus are sometimes very difficult to comprehend, especially when you're reared in a church and the minister does not seem to understand what the real depth of the sayings of the Master Jesus meant as a boy growing up and wanting to be a priest. I asked the unpardonable question, how come you preach of Jesus and don't seem to be able to bring that life into manifestation? My mentor said to me, boy, you'd never be a priest. You're too much of a mystic. Then I realized there were two functions in the church. I could not blame them after. Lack of knowledge was my mistake. Organizational religion is maintained by the priest, and it's called churchianity. Mystic religion or Christianity is maintained by the monks who live the life inside. They attempt the day-by-day experiments with the actual principles of the master, whereby the priest is not involved with that. His role is to present what he said, and now you do it, but I don't have to follow it. As a boy, you can see my problem. And I think you've had the same in your own research. So I left the church and went away in search of my own heritage. Maybe there is a clue. I thought my parent, especially my father, was an atheist. He never went to church, only once a year. The day he was born and the day he was married, they all fell on the 25th of December. Interesting. So you have to be an atheist. But why on the 25th of December? It's the best celebration of Jesus' birth, you know. I found out that he was more involved in the mystical life. But then I could not even reconcile myself to him because the mystic really never see it much outwardly. You sit in his presence and there's actually no, you do this, you do that. There's no communication, just to sit in his presence. So this got kind of boring. I couldn't appreciate my father's views, you know. He sat in, but he had the uncanny ability when his teacher came on a Friday, my mother would prepare food and say, now you boys go out and prepare the mat under the mango tree, and Swamiji is coming. Well, Swamiji was a man with a big turban on his head, beard, and he stood but 6 feet tall. He was an Indian. He turned out to be my father's teacher years after I understood what he was doing. But a boy, I didn't understand, you see. But he would come, and he wouldn't come in the house. They'd sit under the mango tree. My father would go out there, and they'd sit like this, saying nothing to each other. They placed the food, and they ate, and he went away. But my father would seem to have this strange ability to know what I've done through the entire week, even the minutest secret things I did. And I always thought Swamiji was peeping on me. So one time I wanted to smoke and I experimented with smoking with a piece of rope. So no one can see me smoking. And I was in the woods. And that very week when the Swamiji visited, Dad came in the house and given everybody a rundown of their life and put his finger, you stop smoking rope. Well, this kind of would scare a person after a while, but I began to take it in stride. And I wanted to know more of my dad. There was something about him that drew me to him more. Then I had to leave and come to the States. I began to become interested in comparing now the teachings of Jesus from the Oriental viewpoint. And the first thing I encountered in Jesus' teachings, seek ye first the kingdom of God which is within you. This seemed to be the one message emphasized. Well, where would I seek it? It stays within you. So you can just picture my predicament for a whole month trying to look inside of myself, coming up with no answers. Until I encountered a teacher of yoga. And in the yogic writings it states, know thyself. It seems to pinpoint it now. Know thyself. But then I ask the question, how you go about knowing yourself? So the teacher took me back to the Bible and says, now, here is a verse that Master Jesus spoke. Take my yoke upon thy neck, for it is light. And left me there. Well, I think you have read that statement in your own scriptures and puzzled over what it means. But the word yoga is Sanskrit. And when it is translated into English, it means to yoke or unite. Or union. So if I take the yoke of Master Jesus, that means I have to perform some type of union. Now you yoke oxen together, you put them together in union so they will pull. So there have to be some type of union going on inside of us. Take my yoke upon thy neck, for it is light. Now, after many months, the word light could only come up in my mind in terms of weight. And I thought in all terms of weight, never arriving at the true meaning of the term light in the structure of the sentence. Then when I inquired again from my yogi friend, he said, light in terms of the atomic principle. Now this set my whole train of thinking in a different direction. For the first time, real light I'm dealing with. Not weight. In yoga, which is the Eastern approach, yoking, the individual is supposed to harness the light within his mechanism. An actual thing now. But then I was brought back to the Christian scriptures which state by Jesus, when thine eyes are single, the whole body is full of light, and the light is shining in the darkness, and the darkness comprehend it not, and let your light so shine before men that they may see the good works and glorify the Father which is in thee. Now it throws me right back to the principle of light. The war ended in 45, and I think everyone was in uproar over the atomic science. But Einstein gave us the first clue of light. The light that Jesus is talking of to his disciples or to the world is this mechanism. It's a congealed form of light. Now, in the scripture, it says, the Creator set his creation into motion by the first act of manifesting light. Out of love, light was born. From the statement, let there be light. But the statement is a statement involving sound. Now, if you see lightning in the sky and hear the thunder after the two clouds have touched each other, you assume that the light is first and the sound is less. In reality, the sound was first and the light is last. Only the range of movement differs in terms with the observer. Consciousness projects the light. Therefore, Master Jesus is telling us of a different type of light. And he's telling you where to look for it. Strange. When thine eyes are single, you know you have two eyes. How can they become single? The two eyes are acting. Looking out. But if they're going to center on something, they will have to come into a point, like the two beams on an automobile lamp, headlights. You have to beam it. Einstein says that this body is matter. And matter is energy, and energy is equal to its mass times the velocity of darkness square. What square? Light square. So the same light that Einstein is talking of is the same light the Master Jesus is talking of. This is a congealed form of light. The creative intelligence cannot alter it. He's already crystallized it and set it into motion by his command, let there be light. Whatever we see as a creation is this congealed, crystallized form of his command. And the light is shining in the darkness. Yes, it's already shining within the brain. And when you get a blow on the forehead, you see what? Stars or light. But you comprehend it not. You don't know the reason for its existence. Yet, at that very moment, you are face to face with your Creator. You are face to face with your real self. It took me a long time to comprehend, let alone to experience this light and make it work, and understand what Jesus meant, take my yoke upon thee, for it is light. Bring this into harness. Bring what into harness? Two things. I have to harness the focusing of my consciousness. If I was to draw a line across here, what do I have? A triangle. Put it on its base. You recognize a familiar figure in the desert of Africa? A pyramid. It is a firing point, a focal point for energy. And in the human being, the base pins out. And the Creator is the base pinning back through you. You have a direct lining up of two forces in yourself. And if you draw it, you'll recognize a familiar function. Now, you have to line these forces up inside and see the light. continuing my research, I came across the mystic John, who was a disciple of the Master Jesus. And his first verse in his writings goes like this. In the beginning was the Word. I said before, anything can manifest. We must have sound. And Word is sound. Now, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word is God, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt in man. Let's see now if we are talking of something in the atomic realm. Before we can have a manifestation, there is a command, and a command involves sound. And that sound is normally called the Word or Logos in certain writings. And for the benefit of those who are in doubt as to what the Word would mean, it means audible, life, current. Or it can also mean the sound that the atoms make while they're in motion. This sound exists as an actual principle. It's the basis of all existence or creation. Now, if this sound is with God, then it is within consciousness. This is the realization we come to eventually as we meditate and go in. Now, if it's audible, then it's possible to hear it. And let's see now if it was audible. There was a prophet who said, "Lo, I turn to the east, and I heard the voice of God like a trumpet blowing." This body is a manifestation of the divine principle or universe unto itself. This is north. This is south. The top is north. The skull and the base of the spine is... Top of the skull is north and the base of the spine is south. Frontal part of the forehead would be east. And the back would be west. And the third eye in many symbology of the Eastern people have been called the Star of the East or the Eye of the East or the Eastern Eye, only symbolizing that at this point we turn in, the point between the eyebrows. "Lo, I turn to the east," was the sage. That means he had to commune with himself now. And by focusing, bringing the lining up of the consciousness, he heard the voice of God like a trumpet blowing. So sound came true. The experience is genuine, and anyone who has made the attempt to lock in can hear that trumpet blowing inside. It does exist. It's not a hallucination or a figment of imagination. Now, so John says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. The audible life current or vibratory rate of creation is existing in consciousness. But he goes on to make a specific statement that will remove doubt from our minds once and for all. And that statement is, "And the Word is God." Now, when you use the word "is," you've got to be pretty sure of what you're talking about, because you're going to mislead millions of people in the future. And if it is truly that, then the tests of verifying it becomes our responsibility. We can now go to that test, make that attempt, harness this consciousness, and find out once and for all if it is so. After many years of meditation, I can vouch that God is that audible life sound. And the Word was made flesh. That cosmic current became substance, cells. But there are many forms in which this substance appeared. The last part of the verse is, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt in man. It seems that only in the man form that this audible life current can be contained and be realized. This substance contains the sound current, but this substance cannot realize the sun current. Only this form can do it, the human form. We've come to a point now in our scriptural understanding of Master Jesus where we look upon ourselves and say, this is going to be impossible, for the churches have told us for years, he is the only Son of God. And let us go to the man himself and read in his sayings, if he has ever uttered the fact that he is the only Son of God. The Hindus and Chinese, they accept the idea of Son of God, but they don't accept the idea of only being an individual. They accept the idea of only being a principle. A big difference between an individual and a principle. The personal Godhead or the creative intelligence in form is the only relationship we have with the impersonal Godhead. Krishna consciousness, Christ consciousness, or creative intelligence or intuitive intelligence in man. But they do not accept the body form as the only, because body forms are required to realize that principle, the personal Godhead. Jesus said, while I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Every realized man who reaches the personal Godhead state is a radiant light because it's moving through him. He's come to the realization that this light is flowing. He has done the works. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehends it not. But let your light so shine before men that they may see the good works and glorify your Father which is in you. When you make the attempt to release this light inside this mechanism, then you have done the work that is required. Now, here we have an interesting point in the teaching of Jesus. He often spoke in parables. And parables were not a common practice of the Hebrew people. It was a common practice of Far Eastern people, though the Hebrew people are Orientals in the Middle East. it is more prevalent to speak about this in the Far Eastern countries than in the Middle Eastern countries. One of the parables that stands out pertaining to the personal Godhead and the impersonal Godhead is involved in this statement. None come unto the Father but by me. Now, Jesus never said he's the only Son of God, therefore he made a statement by saying, the things I do, you shall do also, and greater things shall you do. That eliminates being the only Son of God as a person. And none come unto the Father but by me. These two statements can trick you up between a personal concept of God and a physical relationship of what God is. But in the Eastern writings, we can penetrate the veil and understand it clearly. When Buddha was alive, there was a monk, a Buddhist monk. And in order to understand the statement of Jesus, none come unto the Father but by me, that's a parable in itself. We'd have to understand a statement made in one of the Buddhistic writings. The statement was like this. There was a monk meditating one day. A butcher was taking his cow to the slaughterhouse. On his way, the cow broke the rope, ran in front of the monk, and spoke to the monk telepathically or in cow's language, "Save my life." The monk, a non-violent man, said, "Hide behind these bushes." Along came the butcher. Seeing the monk, he said, "Hey, Mr. Monk, you see my cow?" Now the butcher knows that the monk can't lie. And the cow knows that the monk can't betray him. What is the monk going to do now? He's got to find a parable to get out of it. Because he's caught in the middle, like the cheese between two slices of bread. So he looked at the butcher and he said to him very calmly, "They that saw the cow can't tell you where the cow is hidden. He who can tell you where the cow is hidden didn't see it." Now, I'm stumped when I confronted the parable. Years went by before I can really penetrate the veil to understand the principle. The first word is they. They who? Only the monk and the cow and the butcher. There ain't nobody in the picture. Then it dawns that they see, you know. They are plural. But they don't talk. They saw the cow and can't tell where the cow is hidden. He is singular. He who can tell. That's the tongue. To tell is to talk. He who can tell you where the cow is hidden didn't see it. Realization dawns upon my consciousness and I realize what my father was and all the great teachers were doing, bringing me back to myself to raise the intuitive nature to comprehend the problem. Master Jesus threw one such bombshell in our midst. None come to the Father but by me. None who? It can literally mean the whole of humanity from the time he was created or before he was born or after he was born. It would be kind of erroneous, he would be inferring that statement to be that. It actually means no one living in his five senses can raise the level of his consciousness to the creative intelligence unless it first centers it upon the personal God presence inside. It's the only begotten principle, the only way in. It's like the guardian at the gate. For example, we're all familiar with an iceberg. An iceberg, we see a portion above water. And the greater portion is below the water, right? And let's say I'm a little crab living on top of the iceberg. And all the goodies are down at the bottom of the iceberg. How am I going to get down to the bottom without wetting my feet? There is no way I can get down to those goodies at the bottom of the iceberg unless I make the attempt to go down. And as soon as I go down, I must pass through the waterline and keep going in the process, in the exposure, right down to where it is. Now all around my whole body, I'm going to be totally wet, not alone my feet now. I'm immersed. Before, I'm up here enjoying the sun, drying myself on top of the iceberg. In the outer realm, in our five senses, we are like that crab, enjoying the sunlight of physical activity, but never getting to the goodies within our inner mechanism, the Godhead inside. To make a return, we'd have to pass through the water line. That is the measuring up now. This is why they call it the Christ principle or the personal Godhead. The me, the real self. No one living in his five senses can really get back to that God self unless he passes through the Christ principle in himself. So every man becomes Christed or Christed or Krishna conscious. Now, one portion of the scripture says, and as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become sons of God. So it means that every crab that will go through the water line will get to the goody. And they all got to get wet. So any one of us who wants to return to pure cosmic consciousness must be exposed to the Christ principle sooner or later. And if you accept the Christ principle as the only creative principle whereby we can return to the source, we will all become radiant sons of light, God, conscious. There is absolutely no way we can avoid it, even an Easterner or a Westerner or an Eastern writings. For the first time, we are forced to admit to ourselves that this is the way of truth. Not the man Jesus solely, but the principle in which we go back to the source. Now, Master Jesus also threw another bombshell into our midst. Come unto me, all ye that travail and are heavily laden, and I'll refresh you. That's pretty difficult when he is passed on, and you can, how can you go to him to be refreshed? Is he really speaking of his physical body, or is he speaking of a personal relationship on a different level? And we have to take the parable of the monk, the butcher, and the cow, and try to understand the words. Come unto me. Well, where would you point within your mechanism if you want to use the word me? You point to yourself, you point to your head, because this is your thinking sphere. All ye that travail and are heavily laden, who are they? Their eyes, they work, travail is to work. Heavily laden, get tired and fatigue. Bored, confrontations going on day and night. Somebody cut in front of you before you can get to the red light. They, pair of ears, they hear all the obscenity and the good things too. And they get loaded down. Nostrils, the polluted air, as well as the good country air. Mouth, some food aren't so palatable, others are good. These are the things of the mechanism that have to work to provide for the physical body and maintain it. Your five senses, you can't work when you're sound asleep. Just ain't no way to do it, to provide for the physical nourishment. And they get tired. So, come unto me. That means daily now, we should withdraw our five senses to the real self, the real beingness, the one principle, the personal Godhead in yourself, and freshen up. You don't need a 7-up now. Freshen up with 7-up, you know. Daily meditation or the daily return to the higher self, and the feeling is to refresh you. Refresh means to revitalize, renew, clear up, and give you the added boost now that you can cope with responsibilities and face the environment again with that inner faith, inner strength. So the Master is teaching us how to turn back to our inner source of supply. So the word master is one who has mastered the techniques and the behavioral principles in order to live. When we have done this, we can then say fully that the experience is genuine and that we are experiencing the Godhead in ourselves. Now we come to another strange parable. I can't cover all because the time will be too short, but they are so marvelous when you try to understand them. Ten virgins, five wise, five foolish. I always feel sorry for those foolish ones that got left out. You know, you think of it, here they are, making up for the bridegroom, and all of a sudden the light goes out and everybody said, who knew? I'm going in. You can put yourself in their predicament, because we do this to ourselves outwardly too. And we thumb our nose at the person who has failed in some way. But the ten virgins, five wise, five foolish, are your five senses working outwardly now, that is, wasting away the energy searching for the bridegroom, which is the delight, the thing that will give you union or conscious realization, the marriage of the soul with the spirit, marriage between the bride and the bridegroom. And if you run outside, there is no way to find it. And you will be burning up your energy constantly till it's all wasted away. And then you don't have any realization. The five wise ones, that means the functions of trimming it or disciplining it. Self-discipline is very important towards God realization. There just is no way you can arrive at this inner realization with a lackadaisical, haphazard way of life, at do what you like or do what you please. It does not work before you, because you'll discover you are very inconsistent and very weak, and you're easily going to succumb to the distractions. Your mind is going to wander all over the world, but never getting down to the actual experience. When you discipline the senses, that means trim them now, prune them, and it's very hard because we try everything, and when they have all failed, we're forced to follow instructions. You know those little cards they have stuck all over the place. When everything else fails, follow instructions. That is a way to tell us, learn to discipline the senses, do the thing that must be done. That is the five wise virgins. That is using the five senses in a disciplined way to center it on the intuitive self or God self, which is the bridegroom. To sup means to feast. When you discipline the senses and steady them, the first tangible experience that comes from that light within is peace. A peace that passes all understanding. One that cannot be gained by the undisciplined senses, by running after every emotional desire or enticement. The inner peace can be experienced, but how to transfer that inner peace into the waking life? Most mystics, especially Orientals do, Christians, you see them sitting like a lump on a log for centuries or for years doing nothing. You say, well, is that all there is to the spiritual life? They are incapable of making the transfer from within to the outside. Great teachers come forth into the world with that inner consciousness just to show that we can make the transfer. Now, there are two types of teachers. The renunciate and the householder. This applies to Swamis too. The wives of Swamis are called Swaminis. And a renunciate is one who has no wife. There is no strength in the renunciate life if you give up. Sooner or later, you're going to have to face yourself that there's something missing. Because one of the greatest rules of realization is greater the obstacle, greater the man. The householder is thrown into a bigger battle now. He has the nagging husband or the nagging wife. And they both are going to go through that constant confrontation in order to experience that inner peace. And before the journey is over, you have a wonderful relationship because no one is going to give in now. Until they make it together. And this is real self-mastery. He's called the householder. This path, Master Jesus had many around him. We only know of the renunciate type, the 12 that followed him. Their lives seem to be exemplified, and a great deal of it is centered about them. But renunciates cannot provide for bread every day, a room to sleep every night, and let alone have a place to go and have a last feast. If you recall, he had a white ass even to ride on. Many things were provided, and they had to come from the householder, who were his disciples also. There are many householder disciples, people who had to involve themselves with daily activity and still follow the Christ within themselves, follow the light. One such man is Joseph of Arimathea. Another man is Nicodemus. Another one would be Lazarus. There were two Lazaruses here. One that was sick, and one he resurrected. The one he resurrected was a very wealthy man. So we see that great masters who live on the earth have two types of disciples that follow the path. The householder and the renunciate. We see this every day in society. Some are trying to cut away from society to find a little place all by themselves. The rest are remaining in the mainstream, working. But when realization comes, wherever it comes and when it comes, you will find only those who can make the transfer from within to the outside are the ones who really are the strongest. When you bring your peace into daily activity now and can take it with you moment to moment with your trials, which is the karmic debt incurred by your wrong thinking, you're only reaping what you're sowing, you see. And you're harvesting it, and nobody's harvesting it for you. So this inner strength that comes from transference is vitally important for modern man to be able now not to leave the world, accept the world as it is, but to make the transference from within to the outside. The peace I give, the world don't give. Get the peace inside, transfer it outside. Then those in the outer world will get it, because it will overflow. You can't give what you don't have. If you're frustrated inside, sooner or later you're going to give out waves of frustration. If you're peaceful from within, it will overflow. And the psalm says, surely goodness and righteousness shall follow me all the days of my life, and my cup overfloweth. Means that the individual made the attempt to go in, to acquire the inner peace, and to bring it into the manifested world and let it flow. It overflows. This is what we're all searching for inside. There are many other goodies too, such as extrasensory abilities, and so forth. But don't be carried away by the extrasensory abilities. They can tend to detract you from your goal. The real goal is lining up back with your Creator. That's why Jesus slipped in one bombshell by saying, what it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? This is a caution, lest we get carried away from the real objective. Now, We have an interesting statement when he said, "You see me, you see the Father." And in my training, when I was being trained as a priest early, it would always say that Jesus is God right there standing. It could not really bring home the truth to my mind. Yet in the Eastern writings, they still say Krishna was God, you know. His name was Gopal. It was God walking on this earth. Why don't you accept it? Why do you accept only Jesus was God? I realize there's a difference in saying, "You see me, you see the Father," and literally involving the physical frame. The individual has attained God realization by entering the personal Godhead, the Christ self, the Krishna consciousness or the Christ consciousness. Now, from the example of the iceberg, what is an iceberg made of? What kind of water? Frozen water. Now, the crab has to pass through from the dry top of the iceberg down to the wet part. What is he going to pass through? Water. But they're both made of the same thing, oxygen and hydrogen. So you see the water, you see the iceberg. I am made of the atomic principle light. I'm crystallized. The Creator Himself is the cosmic light holding the whole thing together. Frozen. I'm free and loose, like the water. When I look at this form, I realize these two things equal to the same thing are themselves equal to one another for the first time. Then the comprehension of Emmanuel, which was supposed to be his name before they gave it to him as Jesus, meaning God is in man or God is with us. The realization is that this principle is within you. Anytime you refer to it, you have to use these two words. I and am. I and the Father are one. I am that I am. The Hindus have a Sanskrit word. It's called Soham. I am He, that am I. So, the Swamis say, "Have you arrived at the Soham stage, my boy?" Now I cannot intellectualize to say yes. I have to actually experience a phasing in of the oneness. And to be able to experience it, all of us can, as long as we know what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to become one with the light, that the mechanism now would emit this. Jesus was completely phased in with the Godhead and openly said to his disciples and the people, "Who do men say that I am?" Put them to the confrontation. And some said, "Thou art a prophet, teacher," whatever. So then our good friend Peter, in a loud voice, says, "Thou art Christ." And Jesus buffed back and say, "I didn't tell you that. The Father which is within you has revealed it to you. the Christ within you, the Godhead within you, recognize the Godhead that is fully aligned. But your Godhead is not aligned yet. And I'm not going to tell you now that you're going to deny me. I'm going to wait till later when you do deny me. So he tells them later he's going to deny him because he is not lined up, you see. And instances show that he was not lined up with his Christ self. One time he saw the Master who is fully lined up. And with a burst of devotion and a love for the Godhead, he tries to walk across the water to meet him. The devotion is strong and he does step across, but not fully lined up. That good old mind of his looks down, and this is water, friend. And that still is a human being. He may be God. So he sinks down into the water. This is the confrontation of the principle. Anytime the principle lines up itself within us, there is no limitation. It's the faith now, like a grain of mustard seed. You have to bring in this alignment. So, in the scriptural teaching of the East, we can understand the life of the Master Jesus better than most people understand him in other parts of the world. We see that there is no conflict now, viewing it from that standpoint. Thank you.
I will have a 5-minute break, and then Adana will be happy to answer any questions.
I guess here is where we lock horns now. You know, H-A-N-G-E-R, you call it hanger. Put a hyphen between the H and the A, and you have horns which you hang yourself on when you're angry. I know you may have lots of questions to ask. You want to go ahead and... Yes? According to a friend of mine who has done a great deal of study, he said to me one day after I tried to convince him so many years, he says, you know, Adano, I finally come to the conclusion, we do survive our decent burials. Our decent burials. Life after death is a reality. What we call death is only a physiological cessation of the chemical structure. There are different degrees of death. Well, let's look at the life of Master Jesus in the various degrees which he spoke of. He was confronted with the daughter of Jairus, a householder disciple. And Jairus asked his master to come and help his daughter. He came to the home and they're mourning. Child is dead. He makes a bold statement. She's only asleep. Would a man go out of his way to raise the hope of an individual at such a critical moment and call it sleep? Unless he's highly familiar with the workings of the mechanism. But just don't play that type of jokes with people. Yet, he brought her out of the state. Let's look at another level of death. He stayed at the home of Lazarus, a householder disciple. And Lazarus was a rich man. and Lazarus could not break the attachment to his possessions. So the only time he's going to learn the lesson is when he's dead, right? In the grave, there are no rich people. So the pattern is to let him go to that particular confrontation. So he leaves the home of Lazarus and takes off. And on his journey, news come to him that Lazarus is ill. But he pays no attention. He's the master. Lazarus is the student. The relatives are all students of different degrees. Later on, the news come, Lazarus is dead. But he makes another statement. This is not a debt unto the debt. What debt is he talking about now? He turns back, goes to the home of Lazarus, and if I were the sisters of Lazarus, you know what go on in my mind? You are the most ungrateful individual we ever had in our home. We give you food and then we send you a message to come and help our brothers. You didn't even pay any attention, you ignore us. Why would we want to help you now? But these thoughts are submerged in their consciousness. So he's going to carry on the facade by saying, when they told him, Master, if you were here, you would not be fearing thus. This is how they have to present themselves after they have the mental turmoil of criticizing. This is how they have to present themselves after they have the mental turmoil of criticizing. I don't know of another human being who wouldn't do it. If I was in the situation, I'd have to do it. This is only logical. The nature has to be satisfied in some way. He says, where is the grave? And they reply, Master, he's going to stink. He's dead, you know. You can just picture the confrontation. So they go, and then he carries on the facade one step further. Lazarus, come forth. He said it in a loud voice. Then he tells himself, Father, I didn't have to say it, only because of the people nearby. Interesting. That he should make an after statement to confrontation with. Realizing this, we see that the master is working at different levels of bodily cessation. Now, Lazarus was dead for 3 days. And yet, he is able to bring forth Lazarus from that deep state of cessation. But it's not a debt unto the debt. Now, let's look at another debt. His own now, his own personal confrontation. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he meditates and has the vision of the physical exit. It has to be crucifixion, nothing short of that. Now, no one wants to see how he's going to die. I don't care if you're the best mystic in the world or most realized man. The confrontation is very, very shocking. Let alone not having a guarantee from the Creator that you may pass through that test and get some goodie on the other side, that he's going to give you some extra bonus for facing it. It's a pretty rough test. But he says, Father, remove this cup. It's too bitter a cup to face in physical frame. But in the confrontation with consciousness, he realizes he must face. Otherwise, he's not a master. What is he here to master? Is he not here to master every level of behavior? Every particular form of confrontation? Yes. Not my will, but thy will be done. Therefore, the Master Jesus did not walk out of the Garden of Gethsemane in agony in mind. He went cheerfully to his karmic confrontation. And all those who were weeping on the pathway to Calvary, he admonished them by saying, do not weep for me, weep for yourselves. Be of good cheer, I have overcome. This is the last test the physical frame must face. Be of good cheer. This cessation must lead to something with a greater value. Facing the death on the cross, he gave up the ghost. Then the glorious effect that came after was the triumphant knowledge of mastery of life over death, resurrection. Now, Eastern masters tell you it is a reality. And those who have read the autobiography of a yogi, the master of Yogananda came back and spoke to him in his resurrected body. This is in modern time now. So the masters who have mastered death without running from it know that there is a higher law behind. Well, let's see our friend the caterpillar. He grovels in the earth. He is on his way to his destiny. And the birds in the air see him groveling in the dirt. They pity him. They would like to have him fly like them. So they all loan him a feather each. But he can't fly. No matter how many feathers they give him, there's no way for him to get off the ground. So he accepts his destiny as a caterpillar, spins a cocoon, and out comes that marvelous creature called a butterfly. And he flies, and he's more beautiful than any bird you have ever seen. Yet he does not rot, when every other bird who dies will have to rot. Death unto the dead. There is the mystery that these masters are talking about. We realize that there are different degrees of death, and that there is no real death, only different stages. Now, the resurrected body is called a pillar in the house of the Lord. This is the perfected body that man ought to strive for. Man ought to be perfect. He has to work his way to that perfected body, which there is no more death in it.
Would you please comment on what Jesus meant when he said, "Let the dead bury the dead"?
Yes. His disciple came and asked him to go home because he had a commitment with his relatives. A master cannot let the disciple get too over involved with past ideas, because those people are still living with dead ideas that are not changing them. They're living with the feeling that death and the tragedy of death. They do not see the need to change and look upon life. So the disciple is admonished not to go back, not to look back into that level. Let the dead bury the dead. The physical dead person is there. He didn't make an attempt to realize himself. Those around him are not making any attempt either. They're going to moan and go through all the ritualistic expressions of a dead body and build a beautiful stone shelter for it. They might as well continue to do the things they're going to do, because they will follow suit in pattern and repeat it. Here is a new life, here's a new understanding being told to the disciple. The disciple must make the decision if he wants to go back to the old ways of life, or he wants to take up the new life, the new yoke. Take your cross upon your back and follow me. In other words, do you really want to move forward in life, or you just want to remain and tread water in darkness or death. You can't. You see, Lot's wife did the same thing. She was told not to look back, and that became the death of her. Turning back on our past experiences and trying to relive them as a means to bolster our mistakes is not making for new life. We have to make a break. That's why he puts it on our shoulder and says, you can't be for me or for Mammon. If you're not for me, you're against me. Take the step. So you have to take the step. Am I for life? Am I for this personal confrontation with the divinity in myself? Or am I still going to hang on with my lackadaisical way of behavior, my old undisciplined life? And that is leading to self-destruction. Anytime we pollute the senses, degenerate the senses, they only lead us to self-destruction. And it leads us back to the debt in which he has come to raise us out from. A Christ-realized man tries to raise the level of consciousness of each individual above the tortures and torments that death seems to present to him. Even what ideas in society tends to imprison him, this teacher must try to lift them up. He must show them an abundant life flow. He must have the way to come out of the frustration of the death principle. So he told them, let them bury their own dead, you know. Today we see that we have elaborate ways to bury the dead. Yes.
You stated that Jesus faces karma by willingly going to the cross. Please explain.
Uh-huh. This is very interesting. For every action, there's an equal reaction. Now, he came to lift up men and set into action certain waves of thought activity. On a group of people who were not willing to accept that wave of thinking. Now, it's not his karma from Jesus' standpoint as personality. It's the cosmic karma, the cosmic law that demands that he must set into action some type of condition to bring on a confrontation in order to resolve and absolve him as a master. He must set the stage for his own deliverance. So we call it a karmic debt. See, he is not doing something that is bad. It's not something that he set into motion that he's going to reap as a bad action. The people could not accept him. When he was brought before Pilate, Pilate wanted to release him between the choice of Jesus and Barabbas. But the people did not want him. They wanted Barabbas. Barabbas, in their mind, was a sort of a Castro, somebody who would liberate them from the Romans. Jesus, having no such designs, does not fit into the plan of their needs. Now, one of the truths in the Eastern writings goes like this. The karma of the disciples determined the fate of the teacher. the karma of the disciples determine the fate of the teacher. What is the karma of the disciples? Hence comes the term in Christian writings, he died to save the sins of the world. Their wrong thinking is going to determine how he has to exit from this physical realm. Now, if he took off and never faced their wrong thinking, are they going to make any change? If they were all thinking right, then the stage for his death in such a horrible manner would not come up. Not possible. Because they are not thinking right, they are setting the stage of a karmic condition that will force him to exit that way. So it's not his karma personally, in a physical sense. It's their karma thrown upon him to face. Yes, he was Adam, if you want to look at it that way. And here he's going to face himself as Master Jesus. But I'm looking at it in a different relationship, and I have to bring into focus now another Christ man. And his name is Krishna. Krishna lived in the world, lifted up his own people. And one day, someone saw him because his body was blue. The light, his aura was so brilliant. He thought it was a strange animal and shot him. And that's how Krishna died. The karmic thought patterns of the disciples determines the destiny of the teacher. Yes.
Is the second coming of Jesus part of his karma? Or will his return karmic?
It's a cosmic karmic law, not his karma. There are only two types of masters, an ascended master and a manifested master. And an ascended master is one who attains realization by a series of disciplines. A manifested master is one whose life is predicted before he's born. His life's work is laid out. And when he leaves and returns any time from then on, he is a manifested master all the time by karmic law of the cosmos, not by his own desire. He is constantly sent into the world to face the wrong thought patterns generated by the world, which will determine his exit all the time. We will, in time, if he comes down into the frame as a manifested master and may not accept him, whatever that pattern we determine in our minds will be more horrible than the one prior. But he has to be able to face that. We may think we're going to be less horrible in our decision to destroy. We're not going to be. If we did not do it in the time of crucifixion, here in our atomic awareness, are we going to be more human? Our wrong thinking is going to determine his exit again, in whatever body form he takes. Because our wrong thinking will outweigh our right thinking. When there is right thinking in the world, there is no need for law. There is no need for a manifested master. When there is wrong thinking outweighing right thinking, then the master consciousness must manifest and face it. And it's the confrontation of facing that will equalize the forces. Every exit he makes in whatever form he takes would set the balance back, that unrighteousness would not surpass righteousness. So at that period, his death set a balancing force in time that the Romans had to change. The inroads into Roman consciousness began changing by the people who were confronted with this aligning principle. Now, we don't know in this present stage who is the most right-thinking or wrong-thinking on the earth. We are going to consider ourselves the most right-thinking because we think we are doing it, yet we may be the most wrong-thinking. When we are faced with a situation, and then we can't accept that being in the form he's in, and the disciplines he may impose upon us to make these changes, then our wrong thinking is going to suddenly set the stage for his exit. There just ain't no way we can avoid it.
In your statement of ascending masters and manifesting masters, you made the statement that the manifesting masters have their, let's say, their life predetermined.
Predicted.
But then they know.
Also, it's all laid out for them.
My view of ascending masters are one that comes from the higher plane to manifest their own vehicle of expression here upon the physical plane. Whereas, let's say, what you said, what is the master that...
He does employ that particular method. He's not a master.
But
a master is not afraid to face any confrontation, regardless of how tragic it can be, because that is what is required of him in the first place, to demonstrate his mastery.
But is it not written in the records that no man is born a master, must be learned in all?
The manifested master's life is predicted. Now, they will know where he is when he's born. He doesn't declare to the world he's a master. Someone knows where he's born. Someone knows his destiny pattern that he's got to take. A time will come when he has to shed the environmental ignorance and demonstrate his consciousness. It's like the chicken breaking the shell. But the chicken still has to grow up to be a fowl. It carries within itself the pattern. So the master is within that being. And when he's born, others know it before he's born. Now, was not the Master Jesus' life predicted before he was born? And his agony, his mission?
The pattern is
set. All seen ahead of time. Yes.
His second return is also predicted.
Yes, and when he takes form, he will demonstrate it, and he will also demonstrate his exit. You know, we at this moment would want him to come and not exit. We want to hold on to him. Isn't that our selfish desire? Because we're afraid to face up ourselves. So, if he comes, and when he comes, the pattern of exit is also determined by our nature. We determine if we're going to hold on to him, and if we hold on to him, we're going to sit down and not do anything. When is he going to take exit to raise our consciousness? Now, he's going to throw this in our lap as a tremendous bombshell. The disciple should be as his master. That means you got to come up to his level now. And call no man master save the Lord which is within thee. How are you going to arrive at that degree of development if he's going to stick around with you? You'll be riding on his short tail. And we have ridden on his short tail for the past 1,000 years. Are we coming up to him as a master of ourselves? Maybe he'll throw this in our lap when he comes back and say, what have you done when I told you the disciple should be as a master? Have you raised yourself? Are you still trying to hold on me? You see what I'm trying to point out? That we too got to raise our own self. Even if he's coming and the form he's taking, And the exit for his form is already there. The greatest tragedy would be ours not raising ourselves up under the necessary command laid down by him already. We are not regaining our Christ self.
How are we going to be able to distinguish between the Antichrist and the Christ?
The Christ is the principle of the personal Godhead redeeming us from our confrontation in the Antichrist, which is the environment laid out to challenge us. Whatever human form would want to be in the environment to push us into our misery, you can call him a manifestation of Antichrist. And whatever form that would relieve us of that misery, we can call him the Christ. Antichrist is a principle just as much as Christ is a principle. They are here. Forms are for confrontation. Forms are for redemption. Forms are for release, liberation, enlightenment, par example. Jesus had confrontation. Moses had confrontation. Krishna had confrontation. All through life, we're going to have our confrontation. The Antichrist does not have to be one single individual in the history. It is a constant confrontation of a principle. We're going to be facing it all the time. When are we going to measure up? He's throwing it in our laps. He's telling us the disciple should be as his master. When are we going to recognize the Antichrist is around us as a principle? And that we have to regain our Christhood. Now we need the form to relate to give us the courage to raise ourselves up, just as much as we need a form to put our distrust or our hate or tear it down. Whatever form we point out as the Antichrist, oh, you, I found you at last, now I can tear you down. Or, here is my Christ, I'll build it up. This is not in blasphemy, this is in relationship to consciousness. Yes, to him that overcome it. What is he going to overcome? What is there to overcome? To him that overcome it, I will not send forth a second time. Maybe it's 100 billion second time that you've been coming forth. Not necessarily the second time for this. We've been coming forth so many times. But I will make him a pillar. You know, a pillar is a fixture. It doesn't change. So something that supports in the house of my Lord. When you accept the Christ and overcome the Antichrist, which is the principle in which we find ourselves around us, that tears us down. Wrong thinking that destroys from the basis of our nature. There is no such thing as a mass God realization. Realization is individualistic. You follow me? So there is the reason why it's world without end. Intellectually, we will sense or think that all will go back, which is in the making of the consciousness. So, going back is not altogether. It stretches out over tremendous eons of time when going back. So man will go back to his creator. But one time I asked myself the question, after we all return to the Father, what is the Father going to do now? This I got back. Start it all over again. try and see if you can reclaim your 100% free will by forfeiting 99% of it and use 1% and go through that hurdle of an antichrist and come back to be safe and sound. You are the prodigal child, and I am the father. Go try out again your nature. Go down there in that level, which is called manifestation or creation. I am the unmanifest father. You are my unmanifest being. There is no more creation. Everything is resolved. We are all total love. Let us see now if the love can be maintained. I'll start a creation back. I'll withhold 99% of your free will, allow you to have 1%, and now you go through. With love for me, let my love guide you, let my will guide you. Thy will be done, Father. I'll walk through this channel now and try and see if I can make the way back. With the realization that you're going to meet me halfway when I come back. Didn't the father meet the prodigal son halfway when he was coming back? Only when this prodigal son decided within his mind to go back. We got to make the decision at some time to go back. So our realization is that when we return to the Father, we are sent out back with the total love again to demonstrate it. Because this is what the love is for. To demonstrate it. Now, returning into the world by volition or by volunteering or by direct command is not returning into the world by an unfinished act, which you avoided. We come back into the world because we have an unfinished karmic debt. But to come down into this world and face our obligations in a volunteer way, how many of us volunteer to go and do something? A great many of us are drafted. You see? Equally true. The sons of God, or the realized masters, are volunteers. They cannot see creation floundering in ignorance. They cannot see their brother souls down in the mire. And they sit back here and recline in the Father's lap. It's not so. I am my brother's keeper. This is what you discover when you the peace inside. When you have found the peace inside, the inner light and the sanctity of it, you are forced now to look out again. And you're forced to get off your metaphysical can and move forward and do something with it. Just excuse the terminology. But you cannot sit back. Even the Master Jesus could not sit back in eons of time. He has to come forward. I guess my time is up.
The Reverend Adana Lay is a minister of All Faith Fellowship in Tyler, Texas. He is a native of British Guiana, and he came to America at the age of 15. He is of Indian, Spanish, and Chinese heritage from his mother. His father was a Mongolian. He was brought up in the Catholic Church, but he was drawn to the Eastern philosophy and thought of his father. He has done research on prayer techniques of Indians in North America and Canada and Mexico. He was initiated into the ancient Swami Order of Saraswati in 1969. Incidentally, he had meditated 8 hours a day for 21 years before he was initiated into this Swami order. So for those of us who think 15 minutes a day is a chore, you can see what we have facing us. His Swami name is Nityananda Saraswati. He's going to be speaking again tonight at 8 o'clock. Is Religion a Science is his subject, and again tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock, speaking on prayer and meditation. His subject today is the teaching, is the yogic disciplines and saints and masters. Adana Lay.
You're accustomed to lectures, but for us as Swamis who study the mystic path, this is not a lecture. This is satsanga, fellowship with the truth. And the only way you can benefit from it, you have to align your consciousness. In the alignment, both physical, mental, and extrasensory are brought into focus. You have often heard the eyes are the windows of the soul. But how many of us really know what it actually means and what can you do with it? Yogic discipline is involved all the time with the eyes. Master Jesus was very adamant about the eyes. When the eyes are single, the whole body is full of light. There's more to it than just conversation. We're going to go into some interesting facts about it. Wish you had a piece of chalk. All right. Master Jesus we use the word master, and in the lecture you hear the term yogic disciplines, saints and masters. What do they follow? It's called the path of the masters or the path of the saints. They bring no new religion to the world. They bring a exemplary confirmation of life from within themselves, and it's called the path of the disciple relationship with the teacher, the soul with God. And the emphasis is on discipline. That's why the student is called a disciple. And what should he discipline? Sight, hearing, smelling, tasting, touch. Last night we spoke of a parable of the wise virgins and foolish virgins. And we know the foolish ones burnt up their light while the wise ones conserved it. The disciplining of the five senses from the outward pull is the key to mastery, to walk the path inward. The first discipline imposed upon men was the discipline of the eyes. When thine eyes are single, the body is full of light. So, if we center the eye focal point, like two beams of a car, to one point, we have a single light which we can see ahead of us. Most of our lives we spend looking outward. Very little of our lives are spent looking inwards. The first basic discipline of looking inwards is focusing. How to focus the eyes. Often I think that Oriental people from so long focusing develop squint eyes. But focusing is first. Well, let's see why focusing is first as a discipline. The rays of the sun are scattered all out. It would not burn anything. Yet, if you focus them through a magnifying glass, it will do work. In the East, we say the head is the sun. The throat is the moon, and the lower body is the Milky Way, a miniature universe in a greater universe. If the head is the sun, then all the rays are scattered through the sight, the hearing, the smelling, the taste. So it really doesn't control anything outside until it's focused or beamed. Master Jesus realized this was the key to go into the light. Now, when thine eyes are single, you have to, single indicates one-pointedness. It indicates steadiness. It indicates focusing. We can sit for hours in meditation and discover our minds wandering all over the universe, never getting down to focusing. But when we get down to focusing, we have to relate. So the first basic discipline or technique of focusing the eyes is to pick a point and focus, center it. The outward object in front of you and look without blinking. This focusing tends to strengthen your concentrative force. At the same time, you become attuned to certain frequencies that you normally would not notice when the eyes are all scattered. For example, when you're driving around the highway and the road is hot, and if you're watching ahead, it's focusing, you know. We have one of the best methods of learning focusing to drive a car, because you have to keep ahead. Do you see the heat waves? Have you ever seen the heat waves on the highway? At those moments, you are focusing. You're actually practicing focusing. The lining up. Now, if you can see the heat waves under those conditions, let us extend it to another level of acceleration now. To sit in one corner and just focus. Automatically, after a little while, the whole room would come alive. And those who survive their decent burials are ever present. Nothing to be afraid of. They are there. They have to be there. They are in a different frequency. And we walk through them totally oblivious to their existence. The elemental kingdom is there. Those who can see them, now it becomes a sort of a curiosity for them. It's like a monkey brought into a zoo to be looked at. Anyone breaking through that mental block becomes a sort of a curiosity on the other side. It's not normal for us to see through this block or to be capable of focusing our consciousness in that direction. And when we do it, we are on the observation table. But we are breaking into light because they are in different levels of the light. And the first discipline that they enforced on the student is learn to focus. Keep your attention steady. So discipline number one is focus. Of sight. Now, there are various exercises to focus the sight. One is to put a dot in front and gaze. Two, training the eyes to focus, get back, focus. Picture yourself practicing an hour a day. Yours truly had to go through it. You know, hours upon hours of constant practice to focus. Now you see why I said Orientals seem to be scrutinized. Pull back. To get to the consciousness to work. And bringing the finger right up within the closeness of the sight and gazing. These are different degrees of focusing. Now the eyes do act like a lens. It can be telescopic and it can be microscopic once you adjust the focusing. The techniques are simple. Patience is required. An hour a day is all that is necessary. But broken up into four periods, that's 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the middle of the day, 15 minutes in the evening, and 15 minutes before going to bed. That gives you an hour practice. Now remember, Jesus didn't come on the scene and perform all his knowledge by wishing it up. Between the age of 12 to 30, those were years of the bittersweet learning, the years of gradually molding consciousness to make it work. He was a master. And as the term implies, he mastered these things where he could use them. So first comes mastery, before comes sanctity. That's why we say saints, masters. You must master these forces before you can live that spiritual life properly or have the moral ethics in it. Mastery is vitally important. Discipline number two is the breath, nostrils, the nose. God breathed into man the breath of life, and man became a living donkey. Right? That's what Brother Francis called his body, Brother Donkey. Man became a living soul, breath of life. In the Eastern country, all the disciplines that revolve in yogic practice or yoking or harnessing involve breathing. A form of breath is involved. Those who have read the Aquarian Gospel, it mentions of a holy breath for this particular age. A particular way to breathe, to raise the consciousness. Well, if you're angry, you do breathe a certain way. If you're tired, you breathe a certain way. If you're at peace with yourself, you breathe a certain way. If you're in a hurry, you breathe a certain way. Also, you have certain body movements. These got to be recognized before you can correct them. So breath is one of the disciplines, the technique of breathing is one of the disciplines involved. So discipline number two is art of breathing. There are many techniques . The simplest one, you yourself is doing it unconsciously. In the Christian writings, Jesus used the term, "I and my Father are one." He was applying a breathing technique in that statement. Breath is life. It comes in and goes out. It makes a sound in the nostrils. Now listen to the sound in your nostrils as the air enters and goes out. What does it seem to sound like? Wind. Can you associate it in language structure? Well, if you were to make words for it, how would you try to simulate it with the vocal cord? Yeah. The actual sound, what, how would you try to describe it with the voice? You know, the Indians on the reservations, they're capable of simulating any song by the human voice. But you could hardly tell the difference when you hear it, if it's a dog barking or it's a human being doing it. This is one of their prayer techniques. Sounds like a train. So we are coming to a particular sound that we can relate to. In Sanskrit, they say that sound sounds like this word. Soham. Now in karate, we have to breathe something like that. So that the plexus is spread to give you now the aggressiveness you need and the control in the muscle structure. And you make the shifts inside. Now, in Sanskrit, this word literally means I am. He. I and the Father are one. Master Jesus, applying the discipline and the identity of the consciousness to the breath, knew fully well who he was. Not intellectualizing now. There's a big difference. This is synchronization between consciousness and the life beat in the breath. He was able to synchronize that every time he sent out the air, he was out there. Every time he pulled the air in, he was in here. This takes years of discipline to be able to shift out, go out, and shift back and come back in. Saint Paul made a statement similar by saying, I rebuke you in your rejoicing, for I live and die daily in the Lord. I have the ability to shift with the movement, consciousness and life, out in, that the body has this apparent condition known as death, the apparent condition known as life. He was fully identified. This shifting goes on inside. Now, unconsciously, you are doing it. It is when you do it consciously, not until that time, can you really be practicing the very first commandment laid down by a master like Jesus. Love the Lord with all your mind. Not half of the mind, not three-quarters of the mind, or a quarter. All. That means you got to be fully conscious. You can't fall asleep. Any disciple found sleeping in the East, the first thing we'll do is give him a good whack on the head. Wake him up. Jesus was not that violent to his disciples, but he sure gave him a tongue lashing. When? In his meditations?
No, both die fast because they're in the way.
Mm-hmm.
They start to walk up Jesus, and they said in the Bible. Remember, I read that he woke up the sick in Jesus. Jesus said, have faith.
Mm-hmm.
What was he doing?
He was in a state of suspended animation.
In meditation.
When you can master this movement that I'm talking of, you can be in that state and cause the boat to and cause the winds to create it to scare the students so they'll recognize the technique is important. He's doing the technique. He's setting the stage for their development. How are they going to gain the faith to overcome the fear of drowning? How are they going to gain the faith to overcome the fear of conditions that face them when they go out into the world? They may be on a boat crossing the river, and they are among people who are alien to their culture, and they want to carry truth to them. These people are living with fear problems, and they may be lying there in that state, and they say, oh gosh, that guy is sleeping, why wake him up, you're all going to drown. But if that person does not have that awareness to set the stage, how is he going to help them? A master does not do anything for show. He does everything to lift the level of the disciples' consciousness. The people in the boat were his disciples, meaning that they were being trained in the art of disciplines. He is a master of the situation. So apparent sleep to them was setting the stage that the boat would rock. The winds would appear to be crushing in. The waves are coming. Their fear structure is under confrontation for the first time. Their attachment to their physical survival is so strong that they can't break. How many of us fear death in many forms, though we don't realize it? There are many ways we are in a state of fear. And a realized master trying to release his disciples from these states has to create conditions to break them. Otherwise, he's not helping them. He's here to lift the disciple up. The disciple should be as the master. That's why he's training his consciousness. So he sets the stage. And he was interlocking with the breath. So when they saw him, he says, be not afraid. Isn't that the words he used? So he is trying to bring them up above levels of fear in their own makeup, things that they would set the mental patterns that cause fear. He wants to bring them past that point to show them. Because breath is life. What is there to be afraid of? If they were practicing their technique that they were told, or the discipline, they would not fear. In the first place, they would not even disturb the master. They would have realized that the master was doing this for their benefit. Because they would have gone out in the outward exhalation, come back in with the inward inhalation, and we've seen the relationship in consciousness acting on consciousness, the master's consciousness acting on the disciple's consciousness. They would have united in consciousness. That's why they said in the Eastern disciplines, the student must always look into this consciousness. He must always line up himself with this master's consciousness.